Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's the Neverland Podcast, episode 71.
Up to Neverland!
Take a star to the right and stay on till morning. Neverland.
Good morning, Neverland!
Greetings! I hope you have your pixie in your pocket with you right now, because I am your host, Jeremy. I am the Pan. I am Spider Pan. And I need you to take that pixie out of your pocket, sprinkle some of that pixie dust, and we will once again fly away to Neverland, where we have all kinds of fun and excitement for you today. Mainly, we have a great interview with a guy by the name of Jeffrey Weissman. Now, you might not know that name, but I guarantee you've probably seen him before. If you have looked at the cover photo of this week's episode, I'm sure it looked kind of familiar to you, but you're not expecting the name Jeffrey Weissman to be connected to it. Well, you're going to learn all about why he is connected with that photo and who you're actually looking at in this week's episode. But before we do that, we of course have to get a little bit of business out of the way. I want to remind you to email me at podcast@neverlandpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at NeverlandPcast. Find us on Facebook, Neverland Podcast. We also have both a Facebook like page and a Facebook group. You can leave us a voicemail, 816-226-6492. Remember that you can also join the Neverlanders. If you go to NeverlandPodcast.com, you will find a little section called the Neverlanders right there. There's a black bar across the top in that link, and you can find the instructions on how you can become an official Lost Boy or Pixie of Neverland. Now, you might wonder, how comes it's Lost Boys and Pixie and it's not Lost Boys and Lost Girls? Well, that's because girls are too clever, they don't get lost, so you will become Pixies. Also, don't forget that you can donate through Patreon. We have a link right there at neverlandpodcast.com on the left-hand side. Or you just go to patreon.com/neverlandpodcast. I am working on updating some of the milestones on there. And also make sure to take a look on the Neverland Podcast website for Give Kids the World. I have a link there. Half of my proceeds I get through Patreon do go to Give Kids the World, and they help terminally ill children and their families make a trip out there to Walt Disney World. So it's a wonderful cause. So by helping me, you also help them. It's a wonderful thing. But before we get any further, how did y'all like last week's show? Now, I know it came in a little bit early. I was trying to get it in on April Fool's, and we got taken over by pirates. And I hope y'all had fun with that. I know I enjoyed listening to it. I didn't record anything. No, I was not part of it at all. It was a surprise thing to me. Yeah, you believe that one, don't you? But it was a lot of fun. And if you liked the artwork I have on there for the, for that episode, I have been considering adding it to our shop on some mugs, t-shirts, or anything like that. If you, enjoyed it, let me know. I need to do some updates to some of our products there. I think I'm going to try to see if I can get a little bit better resolution. But don't forget, at NeverlandPodcast.com, there is a shop logo there. Well, it's not really a logo. It just says shop there on the links bar, as I'm calling it, big black bar there at the top of the screen. And that's where you can find the shop, and you can find mugs, shirts, all kinds of different things, and helping to support the Neverland Podcast. I get a couple of bucks out of every one of those sales, even though the prices, they are are, well, they're not completely set by me. I only have a little influence on how much of that money I get. The rest of it, of course, goes to the manufacturer that I'm working with there. But it is fun to be able to get some product that have Neverland Podcast and show a little love to Neverland, and also to be able to share it with others and have other people, you know about it because you're wearing it or having a coffee mug with it at the office, you know, that kind of a thing. And also, don't forget, if you go to iTunes or Stitcher or Blueberry and find our page in there, please give us a nice review in there. Give us an honest review. If you completely hate me, let me know, and then maybe, you know, share a way that you can, that maybe we can improve it, and maybe you'll start to enjoy this show. We'll figure it out. But, you know, before we go any further here now, we have some interesting Disney park news.
This is Gary Gnu, and the No Gnu's is Good Gnu's show, the only TV Gnu's program guaranteed to contain no Gnu's whatsoever.
Neverland news from the Disney parks.
Okay, I'm going to keep this very, very simple. A lot of you have already probably heard that some of this turned out to be true, but it has been now confirmed this week by Disney that the Hatbox Ghost is indeed returning into the Haunted Mansion for Disneyland's 60th anniversary. We do expect to see him in May. They've confirmed it with some really neat artwork to kind of give us an idea of what he's going to look like, which is pretty much what we've expected him to look like. Those of us that are fans of the Haunted Mansion, which I think is most of us that are Disney fans, we do love the Haunted Mansion. But it is confirmed that, yes, they have been working on putting him back in at Disneyland. No word on him ever returning to Walt Disney World. Well, not really returning. I guess the word they're saying is reappearing, since he was there before. And maybe perhaps he had just dematerialized and has always been lurking there in the shadows. We don't know. Okay? That's what they're saying, at least, at the Disney Parks blog. Also, the Matterhorn bobsled ride, you probably heard about this one too. This was also big news. They're going to get some new updates, some new effects. We're expecting some projection technology, some, you know, maybe some new ways to have the Yeti kind of animated and interact a little bit more. Maybe if this goes over well, maybe we'll get something better than Disco Yeti over in Disney's Animal Kingdom. But who knows? But we don't know when that is opening up. We have not heard. Also, Peter Pan's flight in Disneyland will be opening pretty soon with some new updates to the queue, similar to what was done apparently at Walt Disney World. If I'm not mistaken, that's where I've seen video. I haven't gotten to go and see the new updates personally, but I'm pretty sure it was Walt Disney World that did all the updates into the nursery and some new animations, and Tinkerbell goes around, and they have a lot of other fun with shadows. Lots of fun stuff, and I'm expecting Disneyland, that's what they're going to open with. It'll be something similar to that to make the queue a lot more fun, and so that long wait will seem just like an exciting time. Maybe they'll actually have even some new things that we haven't seen yet before. I don't know. But hey, if one of you managed to get into Disneyland this summer and you get a look at the new Peter Pan's flight, you want to get some video and share it with the Neverlanders, feel free to send it to me, podcast@neverlandpodcast.com. Heck, if you record some audio of it, we'd really be very glad to share that as well. Now, moving on to, well, some TV news.
Hello out there in TV land!
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
A Neverland Podcast television review.
Okay, I'm calling this a television review, but it's not necessarily television. In fact, you could watch this on a mobile device if you wanted to. It's available on any computer or a Roku device. Roku, sorry. But Daredevil has now come out. The first episode premiered on Friday. I'm not going to review the whole thing here on this show because it's not necessarily a family-friendly type of show, but I do have a complete review for you at news.neverlandpodcast.com, or simply go to neverlandpodcast.com and click on news, and you will be able to find the article I wrote up. Actually, just wrote it up yesterday. I did watch the show twice, and I will say that I did enjoy it, but I will say also, I would advise parental guidance on this. It is a little rough because on Netflix you can get away with some things that you can't really get away with on ABC television. So it's not like really, really rough. Like, that's not like an R-rated style, but this is definitely some PG-13 territory. So parents, you know, if you feel your children are okay watching something like that, go ahead. If you want to watch it beforehand and then decide, you know, I do advise great parenting and, you know, making sure you know what your kids are viewing. If you want a complete review, go and check it out. Like I said, news.neverlandpodcast.com. There's also a lot of other great articles. If you've never gotten to check out that aspect of our website, go check it out.
Listen up, all you cartoon lovers out there. Make sure to check out the Saturday Morning Rewind podcast to hear exclusive interviews with your favorite cartoon characters from the past and present. If you were a fan of Thundercats, Transformers, G.I. Joe, Ninja Turtles, or Darkwing Duck, Saturday Morning Rewind is the show for you. Join Tim each month as he interviews the voices behind the characters. Find them on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and online at SaturdayMorningRewind.com.
To Disney and beyond.
One fantastic to talk to that you know who he is, but you probably don't know that you know who he is. But he's here because there's this really great event coming up. Of course, everybody knows 2015 was the year for Back to the Future 2 in October. You know, that's like the big time when he's supposed to. It should all happen. We should have another Jaws movie and everything. Well, to capitalize on this year, there is a Back to the Future cruise that's going to happen, and it's also to benefit Parkinson's disease. Well, not benefiting Parkinson's, but benefiting those with Parkinson's and looking for a cure. And in order to talk about that, we needed to get somebody who knew all about it, and you're not going to believe it who this guy turns out to be. But we've brought on actor Jeffrey Weissman. Say hello!
Hello!
Sometimes I'll go say hello, Jeffrey, and I just get back, hello, Jeffrey. So,
okay. I'll try it again. Hello, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
How are you, Jeremy?
You never know what kind of goofy people I'm going to end up talking to. So,
I could probably out-goofy Jeremy. I'm pretty goofy.
Which is awesome. We love goofy people around here. You've done some pretty goofy things. I've seen where you got to do, in between some acting jobs, you actually apparently do a very good impersonation of Stan Laurel.
Yeah, for 15 years, I was the number one Stan Laurel at Universal Studios in Hollywood.
I've seen some photos, and you actually do look a lot like him.
I'll take that as a compliment, I guess. And as well, I played Charlie Chaplin up there and Groucho Marx. I've played Larry Fine in a Three Stooges team. I play a lot of foolish characters. In fact, I almost hope to get on for your April 1st show because I've played a jester and a fool at Renaissance fairs and kind of silly. In fact, my wife thinks that I'm silly even when I'm asleep.
Is it one of your passions just to make people laugh?
It has always been. I think when I was as early as I can remember in my family and in kindergarten, you know, I started doing my best to be to have fun and celebrate life. That's what it's all about.
Well, there
you
go. I
even belong to a fraternity of mad men and women called the Fool's Guild that throw these extravagant parties, three theme parties a year. If you're ever in Los Angeles, look up foolsguild.org. It's an open kind of party, but it always has a theme. If you come dressed in that theme, you'll have a fantastic time.
Wow. But is your specialty mainly improv? Because I see you had a lot of improv in your history.
Yeah, I have always dabbled in improv, but started taking it seriously back in the mid-80s. I started working with a lot of friends who were studying at the Groundlings. We put a group together called the Comedy Omelette. We had folk like Julia Sweeney and really actually cream de la creme of the improv community during those mid-80s would come and jam with us.
Oh, yeah.
And when that group broke up, I took those who didn't really want to stop and formed a group called the Flying Penguins, and I became the artistic director of the Penguins. And we got absorbed when Los Angeles Theater Sports was formed. We became the Varsity Players. And out of that group, a lot of people that you know went on to very big successes. Brad Sherwood, Michael McShane, Wayne Brady, they all came through Los Angeles Theater Sports, which are still going strong as Impro Theater.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to do some improv back in high school, and where it eventually landed me is we had a local place here in Kansas City called Comedy Sports. Mm-hmm. And we went with it was some sort of high school group. I think it was part of a group I was doing where we were doing like anti-drug campaigns. We'd go visit elementary schools. But we did this evening out on a Saturday night, and we went to Comedy Sports. And I actually got pulled up on stage. And the skit they were doing was they were doing like a talk show, and I was supposed to be a guest who was addicted to bananas or was a recovering banana addict.
Oh.
And so they asked me to do something with my voice to sound like I was disguised voice, and then just had me go out there and says, just be ready for anything and just do whatever. And
So I ended up making this, you know, full story out there that I was telling my tale of what of being addicted to bananas, and I talked about how I would be on street corners doing the banana dance in order to raise money for bananas, and I should have thought about it first, because the person who was playing the host says, well, can you demonstrate that for us?
Oh, yeah, they're going to put you on the spot. Oh, you!
Oh man, you're
the hapless victim there. You
yes,
know?
It was. Oh, but I had fun. I actually, just without a thought, I just went on the ground and curved myself like a banana and started rocking back and forth and bobbing my head.
So you're a crowd pleaser.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, you got to be a bit of a performer if you're going to podcast.
I understand the potassium withdrawals are really severe.
Oh yes, they were. I had the shakes for weeks. So. But yeah, I actually still have the Gimme Pair sweatpants for that. I still have them. I don't fit in them, but I still have the sweatpants. It's like comedy sports.
I understand they have great appeal. I'm sorry, I slipped on that one.
All right, have you got another five more in you?
No, I'm just monkeying around at this point.
Well, as long as we don't gain a yellow streak.
Hey! But you know...
Oh, my goodness. Well, so, yeah, improv is always a lot of fun, but I actually saw that you teach improv. Now, how do you go about teaching improv? Because a lot of it, boy, you just got to think fast on your feet.
Well, it really is more like coaching. You try to keep people listening. Improv really is about listening, daring to stay off, and being supportive. If there's a scene going on and it really is doing all right, and it doesn't need anything to be added. That's one of the, I think, the hardest things to get performers to not do is to go on when it's not necessary. I'm a natural ham. It took me years to get this. And so I'm sharing my many years of hard work and wisdom and realization that I shouldn't have gone out there because the scene was doing okay. You know, that's probably the biggest thing is if the scene is doing all right, don't go on. If there's an offer, seize that offer, accept it, and then twist it, turn it, heighten the danger, take a risk, go to the complete opposite, try different things to keep everyone on their toes. It's all about listening and supporting. I've been very fortunate to have worked with some of the in some of the Second City alumni shows and guest in many different improv shows for many, many years, and it always blows my mind how the really great improvisers make it look so effortless. And in a way, it's a muscle that they've been flexing and working out. And once you get it, it just is extremely fun. If you get a chance to see, say, Colin and Brad's version of Whose Line or Greg and Ryan's version of Whose Line, they're just remarkable. And I'm talking about Whose Line Live, the stage shows that tour the country.
Oh, wow.
It is so much fun. So much fun. And they use some surefire hits. Example, Colin McCready and Brad Sherwood always end their show with doing it's an opera. It might have been an alphabetical opera, blindfolded and barefoot with 100 loaded mouse traps on the stage. It's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So how much improv did you get to use when you're trying to also be, you know, like when you're doing street performance, you were being, you know, Stanley Laurel or being Larry of the Three Stooges, you know, how did you, was a lot of that improv, or did they have a lot of things that they told you, hey, try to do this about every 5 minutes?
Well, in playing those characters, everyone expects you to know their favorite line. More recently, I've been playing Mark Twain, and everyone wants to know if you know their favorite Twainism. For Stan Laurel, there's, you know, certain you know, gestures, the smile that he actually stole from borrowed from a music hall artist named Dan Leno, and certain things with, you know, scratching the head and that sort of look in his eyes like he's spaced out. And then there's little lines that he would say, like, you don't believe me. Hello, Ollie. You know, there are lines that he, you know, time flies like an arrow and fruit flies like a banana.
And they were back to the bananas again.
Yeah, I had to work it back in. That's the secret of comedy, reincorporated. The thing with any of those characters, Stan Laurel's genius or Charlie Chaplin's or Groucho's, even Larry Fiennes with the Stooges, I study and study and study and and try to do justice and get down the what they've laid out and do my best to pay tribute to them and then add my own stuff on top of it. I have a pretty quirky, silly side to me, and I'll try to mesh that and my improvisational skills and work with whatever is presented to me. I've been in situations that are totally absurd, or maybe I've had a choreographed scene with pie fights and everything that have gone completely south because, the party girl, wanted to do it her way, and it becomes complete mayhem. Well, you can't try to force your agenda. You have to go with the flow, and by listening and being flexible and all, it's like teamwork with the audience. Recently I saw Oprah Winfrey at the preview screening of Selma before it opened. And she has a way of feeling an audience and getting into their zeitgeist and pulling whatever's going on in their subconscious and telling them what they want to hear. You know, it's a great almost sixth sense. And one of those muscles that you can't see, but boy, the intuition is really remarkable on great improvisational artists or great speakers or great leaders and politicians. So with improv, I've also used it in movies. If I'm allowed to, I always make sure that the director and or writer, if the writer is there, that they're all right with me bringing things in. There's a film where I play an obsessive compulsive winemaker in a mockumentary called Corked, which is very hard to find now, but maybe streaming again on Amazon and Netflix. And I had the agreement with the directors and writers that if they had time and they liked what I brought in, that they'd let me do it. And so I came up with maybe 30% or more of my performance of stories or improvisational bits that I came up with on the set. And a really good director in rehearsal, if you have the luxury of rehearsal on a film, will let you do things. And like in Back to the Future, here we go.
Oh, surprise! That's what everybody didn't know yet. Ta-da! And
in part two, when Marty Jr., Lorraine says, Marty, get your grandfather a piece of fruit. And he says, fruit, please. And that big thing comes down in the McFly kitchen of 2015. And he gets him a banana. I improvised trying to eat a banana upside down. I had to work the banana back in there.
So for anyone who hasn't figured it out, Jeffrey played George McFly in Back to the Future 2 and 3. Which everybody's going, no, that was Crispin Glover. It's like, no, go look it up. Crispin Glover only did the first movie, and then Jeffrey came in and played it in the second and the third films.
Yes, and so trying to eat a banana upside down is not possible if the peel is still on it. So I kept getting slapped in the face with a peel. And, you know, Robert Zemeckis laughed and they thought it was funny, but it didn't stay in the film. I think you can see it in the bonus material, though, if you get the DVD.
I was looking for it on the Blu-ray and I couldn't find it. I after reading the description of that, I really wanted to see it.
Oh, well, the first release on DVD has it.
Oh, see, now I need to go find the original release. I bet it's on eBay or something.
I think. Well, I tell you what, I'll send you at least a still from it, so I'll be able to prove it to you that I did do it.
See it with banana in your face.
Yeah. Maybe I'm confusing that the golf swing, the four rotate your axis for pizza, is in the bonus materials. Not
and
the
that deleted scene definitely is in there. I just saw that today after I read about it. I was like, I want to see. So, and it is there. It is labeled on the Blu-ray set as being the extended pizza eating scene. And, Leah Thompson comes over to you with pizza and says, well, you better rotate back around here so you can eat. And that's when you rotate around and say, four. Yes, and with the signature George McFly laugh, which was just great. And you actually got this role because of a friend, or I don't know if he was your agent or not, but had known of your ability to really embody these characters at Universal Parks and thought, well, hey, you know what? Could you possibly do this, huh?
It's sort of like that. He actually is a friend and was an agent for lookalikes, but the production had called him looking for photo doubles, and he supplied Kevin, who was the photo double for Michael J. Fox, and then he had called me up and asked if I thought I was the same height as Crispin. And I had worked with Crispin actually on a film at the American Film Institute a few years before the first film came out. So that would have been 83. And I thought he was a fascinating actor, and I got his number. I even stayed in touch, and I said, no, Crispin's actually taller than me, but you know, what's up? They need a photo double for Crispin for what, the new Back to the Future, the sequel? And he said, oh, I'm not at liberty to say. And I said, get me in there, you know, I'll see if I can get it. And I met with the assistant directors, and then they sent me to casting, and then I started going for prosthetic and body cast fittings, and then a screen test for Dean Cundey and Robert Zemeckis. And they liked my screen test, and it wasn't until, of course, the 11th hour that I found out that Crispin wasn't a part of it at all. And I was like, that seems unfathomable that they could do it without him. And I just, I didn't know what to think, except, of course, the opportunity to do a co-star in a big film, and also, you know, to fill such big shoes. Like Stan Laurel and Charlie Chaplin and others that I play, he really laid the groundwork.
Yeah.
I mean, his character in the characterization in the first film really was remarkable. It was so fun and quirky. I just was thrilled when I saw it in the theater. I know that guy. And about a year later, I auditioned for a commercial for Cherry Coke and got that and played a greaser, which in this Cherry Coke commercial that was based on Back to the Future. You can see it on YouTube, I think. And Victoria Jackson is the roller skating waitress or whatever. Anyway, so it was kind of ironic, you know, having this little connection there, and then to get the role. On the other hand, it was odd because obviously something was not right, because he wasn't returning. So I figured he had another bigger project that, you know, was more important to him, and that they needed to fill his shoes. Now, originally in the script, Back to the Future 2 and 3 was one script, Paradox.
Mm-hmm.
And in part three, the role of Seamus was to be played by Crispin. And because he didn't come back, Michael J. Fox ended up stepping into that role, as if he didn't have enough roles already.
Yeah. Just showed how multi-talented he really is.
Yeah, he worked his tail off. He was shooting the last season of Family Ties during the day, and then he would come and shoot with us all night. I was like, Michael, when do you sleep? And he said, oh, well, in the limo from studio to studio. I was like, oh, my God.
I hope it was a long limo drive.
From Paramount to Universal? Yeah, it's 20 minutes, 15 minutes.
Maybe you can hit traffic. And
yeah. In L.A., it's all the time, yes. Turned into an hour.
Oh, my goodness. So were you given a little bit more freedom as the grandfatherly George McFly to kind of translate what that character would be like as a grandfather in retirement like that?
Somewhat. Oh, as you know, I played George age 17 because they had to recreate the scenes from the Enchantment Under the Sea dance, mm-hmm. and the fight in the parking lot with Biff and all that. And they used, you know, me mostly in background doing the action. And a couple quick shots of Crispin from the first film spliced in there. But that's all me, pretty much. And then as old George, I wasn't necessarily included in any rehearsals for character development or anything, but I was able on set to come up with a few bits. Example, when I make my appearance as old George hanging upside down at the door of the McFly household in 2015, the first couple rehearsals and takes, I was pretty much head level with Michael's
anatomy.
His anatomy, his butt, in his Marlene drag.
Oh.
You know, so he was playing my granddaughter, and the orange hot pants that they stuffed and put him into kind of looked like a pumpkin. So that little line. How's Granddad's Little Pumpkin came out of that? So
I will never be able to watch that scene the same way again now. Oh, my goodness.
So once again, there wasn't a lot of room for improvisation on that set, especially with the stakes being so high, you know, and Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis having written that script, they're pretty much wanting what they wrote down. But they also are very trusting of their talent. The one thing I noticed about Robert Zemeckis, is that he casts extremely confident talent. And that way he can just sit back, really, and just solve problems, and which is lovely. That's a sign of a really great director. And we had very, very long days. I remember during the shoot of the McFly household of having 19, 20, 22, and 26-hour-long shoot days.
Ooh, and you were hanging upside down through most of it?
Yeah. Yeah, they'd get me down sometimes, you know, especially for a meal break. But once in a while, you know, they didn't want me to get down all the time because it was would make the day much longer. So they built a ladder with a plank on it that I could lean back on. And once in a while, I'd lean back and everyone would leave the set and I'd be hanging up there going, "Hey, where is everyone?
Oh.
I'm all here by myself." They, you know, all had to go for coffee and a bathroom break.
Oh.
But, yeah, it was rough. But nonetheless, I couldn't really complain. I was on the set of a $50 million film, and I was really happy to be there.
Oh, my goodness. How much was the pressure? I figured everybody felt it. But to know that you had to follow up with such a successful movie, was it nerve-wracking on set? Or, you know, how did everybody handle it?
Everyone very professional in business and having as good a time as you can under that pressure. There was a few moments where there were technical problems. In fact, the shots where we had Michael playing multiple roles, like around the dinner table, around pizza, this was 89, mind you, so this was one of the first times there was a computer-run camera designed by a gentleman named Tondro, and the VistaGlide would actually, in the camera, splice the film so Michael could step in each one of the different characters, like passing the iced tea from Marlene to Marty Jr. or to Marty Sr. and over. Anyway, and so we had to block it, set our movements, and then keep them very precise, and so we could match it each time for each take, and there'd be hours in between takes while Michael would change costumes and wigs and makeup, et cetera. So we were a couple days, I think, into shooting that, and overnight, one of the nights, there was an earthquake. Of course, Los Angeles,
yeah,
gotta have an earthquake. And Zemeckis was probably, you know, sweating bullets, he thought we might have to start from the beginning because the camera probably moved. And apparently it didn't move so much or so terribly that it would be noticeable. And so we got through that. There are other technical things that happened with special effects that were, you know, was pre-digital. So all the effects you see, the window projection of a bucolic scene or what have you, and then she Lorraine lifts the shade and it's a brick wall there. That was a very difficult shot to get. That took us many, many hours to figure out because you kept seeing the flash of the slide projector.
Uh-oh.
And in fact, I remember Zemeckis sent us to second dinners while he tried to figure that out and came back and he had solved it. He said, "Leo, you know, why don't you just hold it out at this angle, look back at the camera, buy a little time for the projector to go off and then pull it up." And it worked. You know, it's the finessing of it. And that really was what it was all about. They were very complicated shots, but, you know, they got them all. Everyone worked really hard. And the beauty of Zemeckis' team, his crew, everyone kind of thought a little bit ahead of him. So it was really lovely. Very, very professional. Really sweet people, too.
I'd say that was a pretty good training ground for Zemeckis when he was coming in again to do Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and suddenly now he's working with a lot of characters that are not physically going to be on set. I'm sure there was a lot more times where he's like, ah, yeah, we're used to these crazy effects now.
Well, it's funny. I asked him that. I adored Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I asked him, you know, I've heard rumors. Is there going to be a sequel? And he said, no, nah, I don't know. And I said, why? Because it was so difficult, so challenging. And he said, no, actually, I've got more challenging shots on this shoot than I did on Roger Rabbit.
Wow. So always looking for the bigger challenge, I guess.
Yes.
My goodness. Yeah. So on the bits where you're being the 17-year-old George, and I guess they're kind of more focused where you had to come in and maybe Michael J. Fox was doing something main in the foreground and you were basically in the background. How much effort and how difficult was it to try to recreate exactly every motion as it appeared in the original film?
Well, in a way, it wasn't so difficult because it was already there and accessible to me. I could go over to playback and say, am I doing this right? Am I lifting my arm high enough? Am I getting this? And, you know, and people would help, you know, the stunt coordinator, choreographer would be there to help recreate it. And Tom Wilson is lovely to work with. And, you know, and Leah, of course, was a gem to work with. It really is. It wasn't that difficult. I suppose the difficult part was, you know, sometimes, especially at the beginning, people looked at me like, what the heck is this? You know, because I'm in all this prosthetic makeup that makes me look and resemble the original actor. And so it felt odd. You know, at times I felt, you know, like an outcast. But I'm kind of a nice guy and a silly guy, and I warm up to people. I'm very sociable. And, you know, by the end of the week, I'm in like with the family. And it also, they were kind of stuck in a corner. Crispin had kind of bound their hands with having to do their shiftiness with me because they couldn't come to the contractual agreements.
So if, you know, we can look at really at their version of 2015, and we can see a lot of things that didn't come true. And there actually are a lot of things that I think they kind of hit it close to the head. Not as much as like Star Trek kind of predicted future technology. But, you know, would they have the video conference pretty much? They almost have like a Skype call on their TV there.
Yeah.
So a lot of things actually did seem to come true, but a lot of things didn't. So of all the things that they had guessed for 2015, what is the one thing that you wish we could have gotten that didn't happen?
Oh, it's still going to happen. Aren't the Marlins and the Cubs going to go to the World Series?
Actually, I'm hoping the Royals are going to go back this year.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Of course. Sorry. St. Louis. Love you, St. Louis. You know, I worked
Well, St. Louis is nice. They've won a few. We need the Royals back.
I'm sorry. Kansas City.
Right. Wrong side of the state.
I beg your pardon. I worked a summer. Oh, boy. Your summers out there are just so lovely. Oh boy. Yeah. The humidity. I worked at the Six Flags down there in Eureka.
Well, I know there's one around St. Louis. There's a Six Flags.
That's the one. Yeah, that's where I got my brain fart there. I'm sorry.
So what were you doing there? Were you doing another character?
Yeah, I was playing characters. They were doing a tribute to Hollywood there at the theme park and spent the summer there. And in fact, I remember being in my trailer underneath the Batman ride when it got hit by lightning.
Wow.
During a tornado watch. And I was like, you know, I'm getting out of here. Getting out of here. Going to a real building. Never a dull moment.
Oh, my goodness. So how many different theme parks have you played characters in?
Oh, several. I worked, since you do a lot of Disney things, you might like this. When Disney owned the Queen Mary, I was hired to play a parapsychologist, a kind of a ghostbuster during their ghost tours.
Cool.
And it was a very cool show. I got to control the special effects during the scenes I was in. The tours would come through. I was stationed down in the old haunted swimming pool. And they had based the show on some actual footage they had of a parapsychologist speaking with a disembodied voice at midnight, and they had sworn affidavits from the security guard and the cameraman and this parapsychologist. And you hear on the video that we studied this little girl's voice, and you hear him and see him speaking to her and her responding and so on and so forth. So it was very cool. I was a month or two into doing this show that they had based on this little girl's voice and special effects, steam and lighting and things, moving chairs, falling over and such. And was doing a show in the middle of the show. Actually, I'd just come out, and the tour was in there. I was like, what are you people doing in here? And I'm doing my readings. And I heard the little girl's voice, and I hadn't started the sound cue. I was the one that actually started the show where the little girl's voice comes over. And I was like, uh-oh. And she spoke again. And the only person that would have known that we were having a real apparition was the tour guide. And I looked at the tour guide, and I said, did you hear that? And he said, yeah, it sounded like a little girl. And I said, yes. And then I deliberately showed him that I was pushing the button on the bottom of my detector box that I was starting the show and the recording. And he did a double take. And I was like, yes, we heard her that time for real. And we did the show. I double timed it, got out of there. And as soon as the crowd left and the special effects wound down, the steam and the lights and everything, I did what I saw the parapsychologist do on the video that we studied, and I asked her, is she all right? Does she need help moving on? What's going on? And she actually responded to me twice. I can't tell you what she said. I couldn't understand what she said, but it was very clear to me that we had an audio apparition. So that was kind of chilling and fun.
Yeah.
Spooky Disney story.
Oh, but there are a lot of spooky Disney stories around the parks. A lot of them end up being just kind of rumors, and everybody gets freaked out, like the supposed ghosts that have been on Pirates of the Caribbean. One of them, a maintenance man, that if you don't greet him, he will cause the ride to break down.
Oh, hey. Gotta be very nice to that ghost.
Yeah. There's all kinds of different stories, and a lot of podcasts have covered them, because these stories circulate around, and I've also heard podcasts that go through and end up debunking every single one, but I've also heard cast members talk about when they close one of the attractions, like in Walt Disney World, they have a lot of dark rides in Fantasyland, and even after, you know, they're closing things down and they go through and they're sweeping, just walking through it, they'll still have some things active, and they said it's actually just scary walking through, because it's very weird to be by yourself with all the animatronics still active.
Sure.
It's, you know, Disney's got ghost stories up the wazoo, and a lot of it is just because, you know, psychologically it messes with you being in there. So,
now I'd have those at Universal too. I'd often do special events at the different sound stages, like Stage 28, which unfortunately they just tore down where they shot the Phantom of the Opera. That was definitely a haunted stage. You could feel the vibe in there. It was really interesting. In fact, after shooting Back to the Future, a couple of years later, I ran into Dean Cundey while he was shooting with Robert Zemeckis, The Death Becomes Her, on that stage, and went in there and watched Meryl Streep do some of her work on that. That was a lot of fun. But the I think one of the more remarkable things, I was doing a publicity photo shoot at the stage that had King Kong in it. And I made the mistake of stepping on the tram bridge, and it activated the emergency exits, and all these alarms went off. Oh, boy. It was comedy.
Oh, my goodness. Well, speaking of frightening things, you also got to be in the Twilight Zone movie.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I'm very excited for George Miller's new film, the Mad Max 4 coming out.
Yes. I'm actually excited for that one, even though I think I saw the first one of Mad Max, and I know I saw Beyond Thunderdome when I was a kid, but I barely remember anything but the song and the big fenced-in area. So I'm kind of hoping I can go into this one without having remembered much of the original movies and still just enjoy it and then go for the ride.
Yeah, what is it, Fury Road?
Yeah, I think
Mad Max
so.
Fury. It's unbelievable. It just is so wonderful. He is probably one of my favorite directors that I've ever worked with. He is such a delightful gentleman. He was a doctor. When I worked with him, it was his first Hollywood project, and he was just taken with Hollywood. He was loving every minute of it, and we got along great, telling jokes and working with him. And of course, John Lithgow. This was the remake of Nightmare at 30,000 Feet. The William Shatner was the original version on television. Rod Serling's, and it just was a dream working with him, because once again, he was a director who said, he trusts his actors. If in rehearsal your instincts say, I have a bit of business or a line or something, let's try it. And often we would try things, and he'd keep them. And it was just delightful, and he cast very well. I loved everyone on that set, Abby Lane and J.D. Johnston and Donna Dixon. There were a lot of terrific people on that shoot. And of course, John Lithgow, who was a gem of a person.
Yeah, and he's amazing sometimes. Just the variety of roles I've seen John Lithgow do, it's just impressive because he can be completely hilarious at one moment, and then he can scare you half to death. I've seen him play some evil characters that,
sure.
Well, he gives you the creeps.
For De Palma and company, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. He's a very, very amazing actor. And
I've been very fortunate to work with some very diverse acting techniques. I teach not only improv, but I also teach drama, teach acting and film technique. And John was weaned on stage. You know, he came from a very prolific theatrical career, and watching him work almost from the outside and bring it down for film. Whereas I've also worked with Clint Eastwood, and he puts everything right there at the end of his nose, you know, and it looks like while you're shooting it, like he's not doing anything. And yet when it's up on a 70 millimeter, you know, on a 70 foot screen, it's very full. And then working with Michael, watching his work up close, where he was weaned basically on television, where he really got his formula, his technique, really, you could see him, if he didn't feel like he was honest on something, he would call it himself. He wouldn't wait for the director. He was like, I got to do it again. I didn't believe it myself. You know, just really remarkable to see his formula, Michael J. Fox's formula, as opposed to, say, Clint's technique, which is all really small at the end of his nose, and Lithgow's, who's really huge and works his way back down. And all three of them work from truth and authenticity, and yet three entirely different techniques. It was really, really fun for me as an actor to see all this.
How intimidating is Clint Eastwood in person?
He's a very nice guy, although his aura is intimidating. You know, it precedes him. I remember I auditioned for Fritz Manns, the producer, and was put on tape. And now Clint was the director, so he hired me. But I had not met him, and I was getting ready to shoot my first scene on set, and I had yet to meet Clint. And so we blocked out my scene, and then he went off to scout out the next shot up towards the forest where Michael Moriarty's character is riding off to town, and Kerry Snodgrass's character was going to stop his carriage. And I followed Clint, and it was just Clint and me, and Clint turned around and saw me and said, yeah. And I said, Mr. Eastwood, I just want to introduce myself. I'm Jeffrey Weissman. And he goes, I know who you are. Who do you think hired you? I was like, oh, yes, of course. But you know, and he was in his duster and his hat and cowboy persona, and it was pretty cool. You know, it was very intimidating, but it's an image. You know, having lunch with him and chatting with him and being social, he really is a down-to-earth, very nice guy.
And for anyone who doesn't know, this was the film Pale Rider from 1985, I believe?
Yeah, it was Clint's return to Westerns. They had tried for 10 years, I think, to get Clint to do a Western. And, you know, I think Outlaw Josie Wales was the closest he had come previously. But an all out and out period piece. He was, you know, really a terrific director to work for. He, I think, learned from Don Siegel, who directed him in Dirty Harry, how to be over organized and shoot rehearsals and such. And so often, sometimes, not often, but sometimes we wouldn't even get to a take. We would shoot the rehearsal, and Clint would like it and say, all right, let's move on. So it was a very quick-moving set. And once again, his crew just loved him and thought ahead of him and, you know, were incredibly professional and hardworking. And also we had a few amazing things on that film that you can see. The film is beautiful to watch. Bruce Surtees, the cinematographer, who unfortunately is no longer with us, I don't know if he was the one who talked Clint into doing this, but someone, the art director, production designer, had that set, the main set of the town, built on the top of a mountain, totally exposed. But everywhere Bruce set his camera, you'd have a panoramic view with the Sawtooth Mountains behind, or the White Cloud Mountains, or the Salmon River Mountains. Wherever he set his camera, it was gorgeous. And you see that, especially if you get a chance to see Pale Rider back on the big screen. It is really stunning to look at.
And I've never seen this movie. Now I have to watch it.
Yeah, and it was freezing, though. I mean, we were so exposed to the elements. Even though it might have been 10 degrees, it was 10 below with the wind chill.
Ooh, was it that cold when you were out there barefoot in the water and fishing?
It was pretty cold there, too. Yep.
My goodness. Oh, well.
I tried doing improvising some comedy on that shoot, too. Whenever my character, Teddy, he was kind of a half-wit. And whenever he got excited about something, he would, you know, fall on his butt. And Clint liked that. He actually laughed a few times, but none of it stayed in the film.
Yeah, that's kind of reminds me of something that I saw a photo of you with Dick Van Dyke is that doing some of the pratfalls and things like that. When I was a kid, I used to watch the Dick Van Dyke show all the time, and I learned how to do some physical comedy from him to where when I was doing some acting on stage, which I haven't done in a long time, I actually found ways to integrate, you know, where I could do a pratfall. And I also have talked to a director into saying, wouldn't it be funny if my character came in and I did this and fell over this or whatever, because it would actually fit for the story. And I had one director that just let me almost have free rein as long as I told him first what I wanted to do. Because it was actually a musical version of Frankenstein that I was doing in a community theater. And I just added all kinds of little jokes of pratfalls, and I owe it all, I think, to watching Dick Van Dyke.
Nice. Yeah, I told Dick when I met him on, starred on an episode of Diagnosis Murder, and I actually told him when I was little I wanted to grow up to be him. And they kind of shut him up. He kind of was like, okay. But, I loved, of course, Bert and Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, et cetera, and his TV show, and really was thrilled. I actually brought to the set an alpaca sweater that I had found at a thrift store with a Dick Van Dyke label in it. And when he saw that, he was like, I forgot totally that I loaned these people my name to make these sweaters. And he was thrilled to see it, and a gem of a man. And he, you know, was very close to Stan Laurel.
Really?
And as well was friends with Buster and Eleanor Keaton, and told some lovely stories. When we weren't on set shooting, we were off talking to each other about these legends. And really a lovely time with Mr. Van Dyke.
Wow, that I bet you they had a big influence on his comedy then.
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. He was nervous the first time he met Buster Keaton, and went to his home. I should let Dick tell the story, but the upshot was that Buster was even more nervous meeting him. So it was kind of
wow.
Very ironic.
Oh, and it would be awesome to have Dick Van Dyke actually come on the show and tell me that story. I'd love it.
You should grab him.
Oh, yeah. There's probably no way I could get anywhere near him. But, boy, if that was possible. I see how far my reach goes, and I work my way up. So far, mainly, I've gotten to talk to a lot of voice actors, and now I've gotten to talk to a good actual movie actor. So I'm working my way up, and who knows? Maybe I'll get Dick Van Dyke on the show, and then I'll probably just be going, that I'll only want to think, you were in Mary Poppins.
Well, Jeremy, if you want to talk to more actors, you should come on my cruise that I'm producing.
Yes, the Back to the Future cruise. We definitely got to talk about this. This is exciting.
I've got Mark McClure, you know, who played Jimmy Olsen in Superman with Christopher Reeve. He was Dave McFly in the Back to the Future movies.
Oh, wow.
He's worked on a lot of different movies, and he's coming on the cruise. Francis Lee McCain, who you know her from Gremlins and Patch Adams and Footloose and Stand By Me. She was Lorraine's mom, you know, Stella Baines.
Oh, wow.
In Back to the Future. She's coming on the cruise. Harry Waters Jr., you know, who was Marvin Berry, who sang, you know, Chuck's cousin, who sang Earth Angel and led the band. He's coming on. We're going to restage the Enchantment Under the Sea dance.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, Don Fullalove, you know, Mayor Wilson.
Mayor, I'll run for mayor.
Yes. He's coming on. He's a fantastic person. He's a pilot for airplanes and a voiceover actor. And look up his resume. You'll be surprised. There's some fantastic talent and an opportunity to get him on your show.
Yes. First, I got to get myself onto the cruise ship. Where can people get tickets?
You can fill out a booking form and send it in. The booking form is at bttfcruise.com or cruisetoendparkinsons.com. What we're doing is after we meet our production costs, were splitting all the proceeds with the Parkinson's Research Foundation for Team Fox.
Which is and, awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, what I guess about 10 years ago, I actually thought of this idea, and I called a guy who had been producing the Star Trek crews for many years, and he said, you don't want to do it. It's a big pain, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, I can't give this up. And so a year or two ago, I called him back, and I said, you know, I really want to do it. And this time he said, I'll help you in any way I can. My dad has Parkinson's now. And, you know, we all adore Michael and are praying that we find a cure, you know, before he gets sicker.
Yeah.
And and the fans, to me, the biggest thrill and gift for being on these in these films have been the fans. I never had really a line of people wanting my autograph before London Comic Con or the Milton Keynes show I did there a couple years ago. I was like, wow, this is – I have to pinch myself. This is kind of cool. And – the same thing when James Tolkien said, why me? Why do they want me? And I said, because you're representing this time in their life that they want to relive or celebrate your work in Top Gun or Back to the Future as Principal Strickland. So the fans have been really generous and loving towards me, especially the DeLorean owners. They have brought me to their conventions to MC or guest or what have you. And I thought, well, we want to give back to the fans, so get as many of the cast and crew members there. And we want to also celebrate and honor and try to help Michael and the cause for Parkinson's research. So that's the theme of this cruise.
Which is awesome. And, you know, speaking of the DeLorean owners, for anyone who have seen on my website the photo of me standing there in the Michael J. Fox pose with a DeLorean, that was actually part of Team Fox.
Right on.
It was awesome. And I can't remember the name of the couple, but I know you're friends with them.
Oh, tothefuture.org.
Yes.
That's Terry and Oliver Holler, who have now traveled to all 50 states raising money for Parkinson's Foundation.
It is fantastic. And they have a replica DeLorean. They even had a backdrop of the clock tower. And you can get a photo in there for a donation. And depending upon how much you're willing to donate, you know, you get a, you could sit inside, you could stand outside, you could stand on a hoverboard. It's a great way to raise money, and also really gets all us geeky people really happy at conventions.
and you couldn't find lovelier people. They are just genuinely sweet, wonderful people, and they have raised now I think over $250,000.
Wow!
With that DeLorean time machine and that photo op, I'll be joining them at Wizard World in Las Vegas the last weekend of April.
Now, I wish I could get to Vegas because I'd go to that one too.
I don't know if I guess this won't be airing before this coming weekend. I'll be down at WonderCon too, promoting the cruise in Anaheim. But once again, if anyone's interested, what I recommend is if you want to go and you can't afford to, find a philanthropist, tell them it's a great idea and that they need to go and take you with them.
There you go.
because it is a high ticket item. It's, yeah. You know, it ain't cheap, but if you think about a 8-day, 7-night cruise with these celebrities, and in addition, we have just joined forces the Star Trek cruise at convention at sea. The Cruise Trek is letting all our passengers go to all of their events, and they're going to have three celebrities from the Star Trek movies or series on board as well.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing. Out of Fort Lauderdale, going to a private island off Haiti and to Jamaica and to Cozumel and back to Fort Lauderdale.
Wow. Hey.
Now, on the Oasis of the Sea on Royal Caribbean.
What dates are the cruise?
November 7th through the 14th.
Which is perfect because that means you don't have to compete directly with Disney in their Star Wars and Frozen cruise. Although I think
all right.
Yeah, I think both of those I think take place over the summer. So doing this cruise in November, it's perfect. So if somebody really loves to go on these fun cruises, they could do the Star Wars, they could do the Frozen, and then they can do the Back to the Future / Star Trek cruise.
Right. Good, good.
Oh,
I like the way you think.
Yes. You could be cruising all summer and all fall, and only one of them, though, goes to a really awesome charity. And that's one thing I've really appreciated about Michael J. Fox is when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, he really helped to raise awareness about the disease. Because, you know, it's something you might have heard in passing. You've heard that, oh, there's some disease called Parkinson's. But Michael, when he was when he went ahead and, you know, told everybody about his diagnosis and started doing appearances and talking about it, you started to see the effects it was having on him. And I really kind of helped, you know, I start to understand it a little bit better of what it was doing. And, you know, will one day, you know, probably be the end of him. I think it really has helped him going out there and making those appearances and having groups like the tothefuture.org and bttf.com and raising the money. It's an awesome thing. I really like it.
It's very potent. In 08, I think it was, I went to one of the first Back to the Future cast reunions in Hollywood, and Michael just happened to be in town promoting a book that he wrote, and he stopped in unannounced. And of course, the crowd just went wild. It just went nuts. But before Michael faced the crowd, we had about 20 minutes with him, with Chris Lloyd and Leah and Francis and Mark and Claudia and myself. And it was just tearing me up inside because, you know, Michael is, as you can tell, is just a terrific guy. He's just down to earth and fun, and yet the disease sort of like freezes him in his gut and makes him have to move almost involuntarily. He's got to walk away and then he'll pull himself together and come back. And it's pretty heartbreaking. And it hits close home to me as well, not only with Michael, my father, who unfortunately in his declining years, as his dementia and Alzheimer's kicked in, his best friend had Parkinson's. And yet he had a fabulous relationship with him. And then another dear friend of mine just recently found out that he has the terminal version of Parkinson's. Oh. So this is very, very personal for me to, you know, it may not be a success. I may be losing a great deal of money producing this thing, but at least I'm going to try.
There you go.
Yeah,
that's the best you can do with things, is you can at least just give it your best shot and let the chips fall where they may. And we'll definitely, you know, hopefully people will share this episode with their friends, and especially, you know, other than the geek factor of like, oh, he was in Back to the Future. But to share with the crews, and I'll make sure we get some links there on the show notes. So there, you listening to this, look at your iPhone, look at your Android. There's going to be links. Go follow those links. Learn about this cruise. You know you've been dreaming of a cruise anyway, right? So this is your opportunity. Go on a cruise, meet some famous people, have a lot of fun, raise some money, help find the cure.
Right on, Jeremy. Thank you.
Yes, I'm a good shiller. But, I've got to ask, how many times on convention do people walk up to you and say, hello, McFly, hello?
Pretty often. You know, there's... There's some signature things they want me to do, you know, especially when autographing a picture, they want me to say certain things that maybe I didn't say that yes. Crispin did or what have you. But I try to, you know, keep the fans happy. The wow factor is generally like you, because most people didn't know or realize it was a different actor.
Yeah, that just shows how good you are. That you were able to slip into it, and we could hardly tell the difference. That's pretty impressive, I'd say.
Well, that's what the boss wanted, too.
Which makes me wonder, and I know we really got to end this here, but I've heard, you know, from different – you have a great thing on your website that has a lot of different clips, and it seems like you – kind of like how I was doing with community theater, but you like to put a different voice to each character. So have you actually ever done just some voiceover work?
Oh, sure. Yeah, in fact, for many years in the 80s, I was in a loop group, you know, where we do voices for background who are not on mic.
Huh.
So films like Heathers and a TV series here or two, a handful of movies, I still get residuals for that voice work. And then I've done voiceover for commercials and some radio. I have... In fact, done a few animated voices, but nothing as big as, say, my friend Darren Norris or others I know who have been on The Simpsons or Rugrats or what have you. But hopefully that will come.
Yeah. well, heck, you're talented with different voices and everyone believable. That's really what it takes.
And Don Fullilove, you know, come on the cruise, you'll hear all the voices Don Fullilove can do.
I'm not familiar with his name. What all voices has he done?
Look him up, Don Fullilove. You know, Mayor Wilson. He'll surprise you.
Oh yeah, that's like the guy who played. Yeah, I'm running for mayor because that guy was just funny in that movie. Even for having a small part, I just love his bit there in the diner. I don't know why that just always sticks with me. Yeah, I'll run for mayor. You just look. I'm gonna clean up this town. Yeah, so yeah, he's just a great character for being a small part. It was really wonderful. So
we do have the hoverboard. The hoverboard is now working.
We do,
but it has to be on a metal surface, though. This company down in Silicon Valley got it working at about, I don't know, 8 months ago or so. They came out with the demo video of it, and boy, they got bombarded. People just can't wait. But it, once again, has to be on a metal surface to make the magnets work.
I think I remember hearing something about that one, but I haven't gotten to research it. Now, I did also see early on in the year there was a production value type of video where they got, I think, Tony Hawk or some other professional skaters getting on a fake hoverboard thing and doing a bunch of stuff. And
yeah, that was exciting for me because even though I wasn't in it, shortly after that came out, that video, because it had Chris Lloyd in it and Moby and some basketball players and, you know, celebrities. My IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, where my page is, my resume, it shot up to like the highest it's ever been. They have an algorithm reading it, so you're rating the lower your number, the more famous you are or more popular you are. and I had never broke 10,000, and I think I got up to 5,000 or something. And generally, you know, most actors are 100,000 or something. So I was like, what happened? And I went back, and I think that happened right after that video came out. So people saw it and must have had to go see who else was in Back to the Future or whatever, you know. It was very interesting. So by clicking on my IMDb page, my rating goes up.
So quick, everybody, go look for Jeffrey Weissman, 2 S's on IMDb, and click it right now.
Thank you, Jeremy. You're a pal.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you for thinking of having me on.
Yeah, anytime.
All right. Don't forget the bttfcruise.com, and I've got a fantastic science fiction movie where I actually play a time traveler that will probably be coming out in, I don't know, within a half a year here. So have me back on, and I'll promote that.
Oh, certainly. Just let me know when it's coming.
I will.
Hey, you guys!
Neverland feedback.
All right, Neverlanders, we have a few new Twitter followers to let you all know about. Toby Downton, he's actually got a book he's working on. If you're a fan of the book Ready Player One, which you've probably heard about on Techno Retro Dads, and I'm actually currently listening to the audiobook, I can't give it a full endorsement here on Neverland because it's not a very family-friendly book, but it is very cool and very interesting. If you enjoyed that book, you'll enjoy Toby Downton. He's got a book he's working on. I was looking at from his Twitter account. Also, Bryce Poole, a new follower, and Antoniza Scott. And I hope I pronounced your name right. If I got it wrong, I do apologize. But that's the feedback we have for this week. I do want to remind you to go to neverlandpodcast.com. And remember to go, if you want to see the show notes, you have to go into the podcast section. There are some really neat photos that Jeffrey Weissman sent me that I will be putting right there on the website, and I will try to squeeze them into the show notes so you can look them up right there on your phone or whatever device you happen to be listening on. Yeah, definitely want to check those out. Some really cool photos, and when you can get a better look now at the photo I used for the album cover you're seeing there, you can just barely tell that is Jeffrey Weissman and not Crispin Glover because of it's in the eyes. You can see it's a different guy. But I really want to thank him for coming on the show and for sending me those really, really great photos. Well, that's all we have for this week, and it's time for us to return to our homes. But remember, while you're at home, you got to keep that pixie in your pocket. And what I mean by that is your young at heart and good attitude. You have to keep that pixie in your pocket so you can spread some pixie dust and share a little love with some other people. It really helps out with your day. It helps out with other people's day. There's so much you can do to pixie dust other people. Sometimes it's just simply saying hello, a good morning, a handshake, a hug if it's okay, you know, but just little things that you do. So try to go and love out on somebody this week, and tune in next week. I've got a lot of exciting things coming. I'm about to have a guest on to talk about a fan film which is about to premiere, I believe, in Germany. It is focused around Masters of the Universe. We're going to talk to him, and I plan on presenting that next week. I'm also setting some things in motion, making some plans to have a nice panel discussion about the Disney film Song of the South. That's coming up real soon, so make sure you stay tuned in here and come back next week. Until then, God bless.
Thank you for listening to the Neverland Podcast. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and Blueberry. We love to hear from you on twitter.com/neverlandpcast and Facebook.com/NeverlandPodcast. Leave us a voicemail at 816-226-6492 and send email to podcast@neverlandpodcast.com. Join us next week and we'll once again go to Disney and beyond. The Neverland Podcast is copyright Glue Band Productions and all original content belongs to the same. Other content is copyright of their respective creators and is used under Creative Commons license.
Good night, Neverland!
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.